When I was originally asked to provide a title for this, you see that it's what I came up with was Scotch on the Rocks. This was because I was providing it before the exciting debate around the independence referendum. And I think that was focusing everybody's minds very much on the challenges of where Scotland was going to be in the future. But actually, really, the job that I need to do this morning for you is to give you a much broader feel for the issues that are taking place across the uplands of the UK, not just in Scotland. There are some significant overlaps, but there are some significant differences as well. And I think people also tend to get bogged down in a few individual topics. So hopefully this morning will give you a feel for the breadth of the issues that the GWCT is dealing with. And there's no question that when it comes to the uplands, we do feel sometimes a little bit like the thin red line. If I'd known, I'd have worn my kilt, of course. But there is a lot of work going on in the uplands that we are involved with, quite apart from the research side. So there are at least a couple of committee meetings a week. These are external committee meetings called by DEFRA or Natural England or Scottish Natural Heritage or Scottish Government to deal with a wide range of issues. We have so far dealt with over 15, it's at least 15, consultations this year on upland issues, and we've briefed compositely around about 10 of our representative members as well. This is not including the work that's been going on necessarily at the same time in Wales as well. There's an awful lot of interest in the uplands. And that's curious because actually we think we probably know what people want from the hills, and by and large it's what we're giving them. What we're giving them is a heathery hill with a loch at the bottom and a red deer stag on the top. Now, that's certainly true of what the Scottish people wanted in 2006, but as I understand it from Vox Pop, studies that SNH have conducted since, that is broadly what people expect, the primary landscape to look like in a lot of the uplands. And I think it's broadly true for a lot of the UK generally. And of course, game management produces a lot of these public goods. The work of the Loddington Project, they get everywhere. The work of the Otterburn Project showed so very clearly the role that game management, particularly predator control, plays in producing wading birds. Here are lapwing. The work that we've conducted in Scotland over the years valuing grouse moor economic activity shows how important that is, the role of shooting into remote rural economies. We've done research with others that show that actually grouse moors are one of the principal mechanisms for retaining sheep in the uplands. It's a significant issue. It's actually destocking now. And indeed, the recent road slippages on the Rest and Be Thankful, which some of you may well be aware of, are increasingly thought to be because actually there's too little livestock now on these hills. The weight of vegetation is actually building up on the hillsides and causing a slippage down the hill. So the Scottish Government is now looking at how to protect Scotland's roads from extreme weather by re-establishing flocks. Our work a number of years ago in the 2000s showed so very clearly that actually it is grouse moors that retain heather cover across the country. And those grouse moors and that heather cover is what drives the vibrant tourism industry on both sides of the border. These are the famous Lochs and Glens buses that you see touring the Scottish Highlands, really benefiting from all the work that grouse managers do. And of course, there's the food production. We all want to make sure that we have heather honey on the table at breakfast and something delicious on our plate in the evening. So why on earth is there so much conflict or discussion around the uplands? Well, a lot of it is to do with actually there are changing priorities, and these are global, and they've been happening over many years, and Alistair's already touched on some of them. And essentially, we're heading towards a much more global interest in food, fuel, and fibre. In the lowlands, this is driven this concept of sustainable intensification. More grain, so we need to feed ourselves, more birds at the same time, and cleaner water. And of course, this fly-by-night operation, the Allerton Project, which some of you may have heard of, is a rather good demonstration of how, in fact, sustainable intensification can be done. The UK uplands have become a debate of almost the flip side of the same coin, because really there the debate is about sustainable de-intensification, arguably. And that's in the search of what? Well, it's really in the search of other ecosystem services, as they become known, or other public goods. And there are really five that I'd like to pull out. The first is one that's been well talked about, and that's carbon. Increasingly, government strategy on both sides of the border is to increase and protect the amount of carbon that is stored in order to help meet our climate change ambitions. This is not peat. This is actually Alan MacLeod. But he's standing beside an awful lot of peat. And one of the challenges you can see here, this peat horizon is now drying out, having had a road driven through it. And that is a major concern, because this is now emitting all sorts of interesting greenhouse gases. The UK, just to put this in context, has somewhere between 3 and 7 billion tonnes of carbon stored in peat. And that is equivalent to something in the region of 25 to 100 years of UK carbon dioxide emissions. So if the government policy, for right or wrong, is to protect and to reduce our carbon emissions, protecting that stuff, the black stuff, is extremely important. And that is what's driving a lot of debate in the uplands. Water is often a consequential part of that discussion. People essentially, downstream from grouse moors, want their water regular. They do not want it in large quantities that's going to come under their doorsteps. And they want it clean. And particularly interestingly, they don't want it coloured, which I always find quite interesting. A lot of us actually quite enjoy a glass of peaty brown water, but many people don't. Now, in blue, I'm picking out a couple of issues that are uniquely, perhaps, or to a larger extent, perhaps Scottish. Health and well-being is a phrase that might not have come across your radars, but it's a big issue in Scottish policy. And really, this is to do with community engagement and inclusion. Recreation fits into this, and these are all the disturbance issues, which are perhaps more of an issue south of the border. Community, hugely important part of Scottish scene now. Social inclusion is really what is driving a lot of the political differences across the borders increasingly. And finally, fuel. And again, in Scotland, we have a very challenging target to have 25% of Scotland covered with trees by 2050. And this is likely to have an enormous impact on all ecosystems, not just grouse moors, but actually arguably down into the agricultural land as well. So there is a big package of other ecosystem services that people are now wanting our upland landscapes to take a role in playing and delivering. And one might say, well, why not? Adapt and die is the problem. A lot of people who currently manage their grouse moors in the uplands are very concerned that actually they don't know that they could provide these ecosystem services without damaging irretrievably the things that they are already investing in. That first slide, all of those wonderful wading birds and the heather itself and the tourism and the investment into the remote rural economies. And we don't have answers to questions such as, can moors be burnt less and still maintain grouse? Can we, in fact, block up the drains without reducing heather cover? Heather is an enormous conservation resource for the UK. It is rarer than the rainforest, and it has the same conservation standard. Can access, disturbance, and fire risk be managed under these new ecosystem services? And is grouse recovery possible with raptor predation? Because there are changing demands for other kinds of biodiversity as well. And here the graph shows the modelled trend in the grouse population during the first Langham project. In the red, that was the trend in the grouse population between April and July when raptors were present and exerting a predation pressure. And in blue, what was expected if, in fact, there was little or no raptor predation pressure. And this is still a very live debate. Can we accommodate these birds of prey? At least generally, we agree with most stakeholders, external stakeholders, and indeed, even ironically, with Natural England and Scottish Natural Heritage, that woodlands are not moorlands. This does appear to have sunk in, and actually there is an increasing feeling that actually the one thing that we can all agree on is that we do not want any more large blocks of Sitka spruce, or indeed even large amounts of native woodland, breaking up our residual open heather moorland. So that's quite an encouraging step. That's not to say there won't be places where we probably should be thinking about accommodating scrub. These pressures, however, are continuing to change, to deliver more ecosystem services. And there are increasing drives and pressure to encourage people, to force people, to actually think about different ways of managing the uplands. And the challenges are all there to see, and the risk is that, in fact, some of the swords, some of the tools that are used in the uplands will be turned into blunt instruments as a result of a lot of change and pressure that's going on. A lot of what we deal with in these committees is making sure that we don't lose tools from the toolbox. So Muirburn, we've already discussed, should we use Muirburn? Should it be part of the upland management assemblage at all? Predator control, always under pressure. We have to look at welfare. We have to make sure the equipment is right. When should we be doing it? In Scotland, of course, we've had restrictions on the general licences. If there is a civil liability or a civil burden of proof to suggest that there might have been wildlife crime committed. Species management. In Scotland, we're facing the issue of, is it right to significantly reduce deer and hare populations, even if that's for a short period of time, in order to allow habitat or indeed other species recovery? And parasite management. Is it indeed appropriate that we should be putting out medication for a wild animal in the shape of medicated grit for grouse? All of these are challenges and are pressures that are being forced upon the grouse management community. And one might say, well, what the hell have you been doing? Well, we've been rolling the pitch, obviously. And there's Teresa in red, making sure that we're rolling the pitch in the right direction. And we've been rolling the pitch in the directions you'd expect the Trust to be doing it. And the first is, we've been researching the issues. So we've been addressing these questions of uncertainty. And we've been researching in the top left-hand corner. You might not see it so very clearly. That is actually a grouse and her nest that were burnt over during a wildfire. And we've been researching, actually, whether, in fact, the laying date of grouse is getting earlier and might be getting very close to the legal rotational burning period. And I'm glad to say that at the current time, there are at least 50 years before, in fact, the average grouse laying date and the burning period are likely to overlap. So we've got a bit of time there. But this was a wildfire that actually destroyed this nest. And what we've been looking at, the graph on the bottom here, shows three columns. One, the first one, the building phase. This is when heather is very young and low. And you can see that, in fact, the rate of spread of fire in meters per second is fairly modest in low fuel-loading habitats. But when you get to mature heather, fire can spread very quickly. 8 meters per second is not to be laughed at. It is pretty much as a brisk walk. And when that brisk walk is traveling at around about 600 degrees C, it gets quite exciting to manage. And these are the sorts of things that we're concerned about, that if rotational Muirburn is lost from the toolbox, then in fact we actually might end up with more wildfire and more damaging fires that actually impact on the carbon store negatively. We've also been looking at what, in fact, the carbon flux, how much carbon changes exchange occurs when moors are burnt as well. And we've commissioned a leading academic, Fred Worrell, from Durham University to conduct that work for us. And it's telling us that actually we need to be very careful about writing off muir burn as always being damaging. There are certain rotational periods when, in fact, if you have long periods of fire, you might actually end up with more carbon accumulated in the system. So we're bringing this evidence forward. And we're bringing this evidence forward to the practitioners. On the left is a Crofter's fire on the Ascent Peninsula. I'm afraid to say that in Scotland, a lot of public perception about wildfire is driven by either deliberate and reckless fires by land managers, such as that. You can see that someone has lit a line of diesel, it's burnt through, it's taken out a birch stand, and is just smouldering away, probably into the peat, having destroyed a whole lot of very interesting lichen-rich rocks on its way. So we want to make sure that the skills on the right-hand side and the techniques and the tools that, in fact, are available to grouse moors are actually much more available to all land managers. That, in fact, the land managers that are using fire responsibly on the right-hand side of the picture are not actually constrained in their ability by some of the less good activity of the members of the public and indeed members of other practitioner groups. And this is a theme: research the issue, deliver it to practice, that has stood us in good stead when we've been talking about snares and traps. We've had a lot of debate in Scotland, of course, about how snaring should be developed, and it's the GWCT's research that's developed the new snaring technology, the swivels, the breakaway clips that are being introduced into snaring mantra. We've also ended up, of course, with compulsory training for snaring, and this is no bad thing. We've actually driven up standards, undoubtedly, of a whole class of people that are actually out doing snaring, and the numbers of snaring, illegal snaring incidents, is falling every year, I'm delighted to say, probably as a result of that training. The same issues apply to the right-hand side, trapping of corvids. We're having to look to make sure that we can justify the trapping of corvids, and I'm delighted to say we're working with Scottish Government on a research programme which is actually considering how important that is and at what times of year trapping these birds is most effective. We're also branching into other areas, because actually we can have the tools and we can have the advice, but actually sometimes the issues are more complex, and conflict resolution is an increasingly important area. We're deeply embedded, of course, within the Langham Moor demonstration project, and I pay open tribute to Teresa, who has sat on the board of directors for that project and really guided it with immense skill along over the years. It has been very difficult to persuade some of our partners to go to the experimental stages of the work that we would actually seek, but we are gathering as much hard evidence and data as we possibly can do. This is a buzzard with a GPS a satellite tag on it, so we can actually measure, we can monitor its foraging distribution and collect its pellets to see what it's been eating. We've been making sure that people understand that if the incentive to manage for grouse is lost, the snare that you can see Graham Dolby here holding on the left, that in the payment for that snaring activity will go across the uplands. And Graham is explaining that to the Scottish Minister of the Environment, Paul Wheelhouse. We're testing new techniques. In the bottom right-hand corner here is a diversionary feeding post with two white rats left on it. These are the posts that are set out to actually divert the harriers away from eating grouse broods. And this has been enormously successful. And we have been at the forefront of actually helping Natural England and Scottish Natural Heritage rewrite their management codes. They undoubtedly, these diversionary feeding posts, reduce the number of grouse that are brought to harrier nests. What we haven't seen, however, is an increase in the numbers of grouse as a consequence of that. And that's where, again, the conservation conflict becomes much more challenging to deal with. And again, I pay tribute to Andrew Gilruth, who here took part in the controversial conservation debate with a wide range of stakeholders, where, in fact, we were getting down to the brass tacks of understanding what is needed in the uplands in order to have healthy, sustainable populations of birds of prey underpinned by exceptional investment and management of grouse moors driven through grouse shooting. We're also trying to push the envelope a little bit on something called action research. We want to make sure that we're gathering as much data as possible to understand what the direction of travel should be on conservation. And although this species is arguably only just about uplands and shouldn't really creep into this conversation, we are very concerned about the conservation status of the capercaillie, as many other organisations are as well. And we acknowledge that actually weather, here is a chick that's drowned, and habitat are key factors. But we're exceptionally interested to understand what we can actually do now to protect some of the remaining only perhaps 1,000 cock kappa that are left in Scotland and thus in the UK. And one of the things that we can do is certainly understand the importance of general predators, the crows and the foxes, but we should also understand whether, in fact, some of the once rare, now common predators, such as the pine marten, are having an impact as well. So maybe there is a need to manage their impact in the places which are becoming more resilient. We are thus generating a huge amount of evidence about the role that game conservation can play in protecting and delivering wildlife and ecosystem goods in the uplands. And that's just as well, because evidence reviews, both by perhaps partial organisations such as Animal Aid and maybe impartial organisations such as Natural England and Scottish Natural Heritage, have been all the rage. They have been gathering together their evidence for what they believe moorland sustainability will look like in the future. And actually, they are coming forward with what their views are on how moors should look. So what indeed, therefore, is our view? What is our vision of a sunlit upland? I suppose you might say that, simplistically, that we want to make sure that there is going to be heather honey still for tea. We were delighted recently to partner the Bumblebee Conservation Trust in the production of this fact sheet, which is managing moorland for bumblebees. The Bumblebee Conservation Trust absolutely understood in this document that the reason that there is heather moorland, that bumblebees and some unique bumblebee assemblages exist, is largely because these are maintained for sporting purposes across large areas. And so we are going to be, we will continue to be actively promoting, probably with our partners, the Scottish Land and Estates and the Moorland Association, the positives. We'll be accentuating the positives of biodiversity that, in fact, game and wildlife conservation maintains and protects, that is of international importance. That Muirburn can, under some circumstances, be an important tool to produce more carbon storage and protection. That tick control can mean healthy livestock. Heather means satisfied tourists, and managed access engages the public. These are all important, good things that we must celebrate and look to protect. But we will be challenging. Raptors should be present at high grouse densities. They may be an inconvenience, but it should be an inconvenience that we accept. Medication should be minimised. Burning must be planned if we're going to get the best from it. Roads have to be expensive, because that means that they are going to do probably little damage and more good. Training in many areas should be compulsory, and action research so that we understand the impacts should be encouraged. And these are challenges for many of our partners, not just those who are running moors, but for those who are actually trying to influence upland policy as well. And we've come up with a dreadful acronym, inevitably moors, because we believe that we must maintain grouse moor management's delivery of cost-effective conservation, that will make sure that the obligations to protect our national biodiversity targets, things such as golden plover and curlew and lapwing, which are increasingly finding their refuges in the uplands, will be maintained. We've got to organise more research and training to improve best practice, so that people get better at managing the uplands and delivering these many other things that are wanted by society. We've got to resolve the wildlife conflict through evidence-led policy and licensed interventions where necessary. This is this thing that I talked about being grown up in the context of the beavers. And finally, we've got to stimulate in the land management community interest and acceptance of the multifunctional use of moorlands as well. There are an awful lot of challenges in the uplands. I hope I can only have given you a feeling or a flavour for what they are in this very brief presentation. It is more than about birds of prey. It's more than about the Ember Muirburn Research Project. Many of these are interlocking and overlapping. I hope I've given you a feel, and I'm very happy to take any questions that you have. Thank you.